that. Something that drove it into it. If it had a hunt to it, I missed that. I don't think it had any kind of robot arm or anything. Look at pictures of it. It looked like a big, round disc with a bunch of aluminum foil on it. I think it was only about 5 feet wide, you know. On Earth, it weighed, I think, 1,400 pounds. It's relatively small. The trace one, that's going to detect atmosphere, methane, and all of that. That's different. But that's in a highly elliptical orbit. Something like a couple hundred, I think 300 miles by 50,000 miles. And that's going to decrease over time. That's going to use aero braking. So trace will become operational probably in the beginning of the next year, January or February. It'll take them that long to, or even longer, to circularize their orbit. But they will do that probably. They're pretty good at doing that. But last time they tried something similar to this was 2003, when they sent the Mars Express, and that's been operating ever since, so a very successful orbital spacecraft. But they sent its counterpart, Beagle 2, down to the surface, and that didn't make it. Crashed. It took until, I think, that was probably last year, beginning of last year, to locate Beagle 2, all those years later, on the surface, and the one that found it was MRO, and it's the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's our orbiter. We drop it. And that used the high-rise camera on board the spacecraft to locate that. What they did is they took so many images, and somebody eventually went through them all, and they found Beagle 2. Now, this one was different. They knew where it hit its landing spot. They knew the parachute opened. So they knew the ellipse where it was landing. So as MRO went over, they have a couple of cameras on board. They use their, regular camera. And they pretty much saw a dot, confirmed it with the high-rise the next time it went over. They took a picture with the high-rise camera. And So it's got very good resolution. So they know they see the spacecraft, the little crater that it made, and they also see the parachute with the high-rise camera on board MRO. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to the launch of the orbital ATK and Cygnus, that kind of a launch, the Cygnus, I think you're saying, is going to be used to store refuse, and it's going to come back down and burn up. Elon Musk is moving in the direction of making as many of the portions of the launch system recoverable. He wants the main booster he's now bringing back down. I wonder if how far is he into the planning or doing of the second stage, and maybe he's going to eventually bring the whole Dawn craft back and everything becomes reusable. How is he doing in that direction, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, right now he's pretty much concentrating on finding the problem of the explosion that took place down at Cape Canaveral on Launch Complex 40 on September 1st. But he does, he's not going to stop. He's got engineers and people working on all the different aspects of different vehicles that he wants to launch. And he's done well with the booster stage. He hasn't relaunched one yet. That would have happened probably in about another month or so if it wasn't for that explosion. So I'll probably see see that in 2017 once he gets things rolling again. According to Shotwell, he's got her first name, she's the president of SpaceX. They should be flying again by the end of the year because they believe they've narrowed the problem now to cryogenic fueling of the system. And so if they change that system, they think they could probably solve this problem that happened on the launch pad. As far as reusability goes, yeah, he's able to bring the boosters back. He's brought them back to land successfully two times. He brought them back on a ship out at sea four times. We drop it. His goal, of course, eventually would be to bring mostly everything back. He's got plans on bringing the crewed vehicle as well as the future cargo vehicles that go up to the space station back propulsively. So no parachute, just a heat shield, and then propulsively bringing the vehicles back to land. The fairings, which cost a couple $1 million, that enclose a spacecraft. Not, it doesn't enclose the Dragon. The Dragon is open, but you know, when you're sending up a cargo or crew, that will be open. But when you send up satellites, either to geosynchronous orbit or low Earth orbit, it's encapsulated in these fairings, and they cost a couple $1 million each. There's two of them on each flight, and probably next year, you know, maybe the end of the next year, you might see those coming down on parachutes. He wants to reuse the fairings. Why throw them away? So he's been working on that. He's had sensors and everything on that, you know, trying to determine their flight capability coming back. And of course, the last thing would be the second stage. Very difficult. At this time, he has no plans on doing it. But long-term plans, he would love to be able to do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's 10 years down the road. So that's the story. And I don't want to forget John's topic. He asked about the experiment, so I should cover that. Let me drop it. We'll get back to the other topics, but I'm sure whoever sent that email in, I don't even know if they're up this late, but we'll try to cover it anyway. All the Apollo missions that went up, when they did EVAs out on the moon, they left experiments all over the place. They call them ALSEPs, the ALSEPs, which stood for Apollo Lunar Surface Experiments Packages, and they had RTGs to power them, radio isotope thermal electric generators. Well, Apollo 11 did it, but 12, 15 days or so. They said 2 days, you know, 2 weeks. But a lot of them last a very long time, and one of them, the astronauts drilled into the surface. I think they went down, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet or something like that, and then put the sensor in that, and that was to determine the heat flow, you know, inside the moon. I understand that worked quite a while, but of course, the one and only one that worked all these years later is the passive one, the laser mirror. They had a laser ranging finding mirror type thing that they would leave on the moon, and you would shoot lasers, and you can still do it today. We drop it from the Earth to the moon. You could detect exactly how far the moon is. Instead of saying a quarter of a million miles, now we can say it's 238,000 and something or other miles, and probably right down to how many inches. I think the that's the story on that. All right. Hope that answered the person's question, John. And let me turn it back to Dick. But that, yeah, nothing else is really working. Those things are long gone. We need new missions to the moon for more experiments. Back to you, Dick.
On Apollo 15, which is one of the ALSIP packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package, and the downlink frequency was something in the vicinity of 2270, 2275. I've got a chart with those exact frequencies. I listened to that signal, that 1 watt signal, I think it's 1 watt, with the equipment I was using to listen to the Apollo 15 astronauts. We tuned to the different frequency with our frequency synthesizer. It really was a spectrum analyzer as a front end with a ham radio receiver in the IF strip of the spectrum analyzer to actually do the tone demodulation, to hear the tone of the carrier. The fact that those ALSIP packages were powered by a nuclear generator implies that they have a very long potential life. I'm not sure, but I would guess that each of the ALSIP packages had their own designated frequency. Therefore, in theory, they could be left running for a long time. And did they really run down, or were they specifically turned off, to your knowledge, Paul, is question number one. And question number two, I believe a number of those ALSIP packages had a probe that went into the moon, so that became a seismic indicator. And therefore, when a meteorite struck moon, the seismic indicator on the ALSIP packages would relay down to Earth the ringing sound that went on for, I think, a number of minutes. So, do you believe they intentionally turned off those packages? Because I don't think they ran down. I think they may have intentionally turned them off to make sure it's not interfering with something else, and maybe they wanted to reuse those frequencies. Back to you on that one, Paul. And by the way, six of them, Apollo 12 through 17, is six ALSIP packages. I'm having trouble believing they turned every one of them off. WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, I don't know if they shut them down or if they just stopped working, but I would imagine in 40 years, they started off at 70 watts, you know, RTG power. That's what, you know, every one of them had that. And I remember Apollo 12, that was Conrad and Bean. Conrad was the main guy, Pete Conrad. And it was a Bean's job to get the RTG out and load it into this thing to get it going. And but he said he could feel the heat through his suit. You know, this gives off a lot of heat. And it was amazing that they were fooling around with these things like it was nothing. But, you know, he could feel the heat. So I know they deplete some, you know, quite a few percentages every year. So maybe after 40 years, I think it's 80, yeah, what is it, 82 years, I think, is a half, they you know, you don't, it's a hefty amount of power. But whatever they were putting out, 70 watts, that probably went down to 30 or 40 watts. Yeah, probably still usable. But, yeah, the central package, they call it, that had the antenna, the helical antenna. That's what about, all I remember about that. And the astronaut would face it toward Earth. Let me drop it. They had the seismology experiments, so you're right about that. And they used to measure the amount of electrons on the surface, and if the lunar surface had any kind of infinite or finite, I guess a finite atmosphere, they'd want to test for that. And like I mentioned before, a heat flow experiment along with solar wind. So, I don't know. You know, whether or not they got it enough information probably out of those units and decided to shut it down. Maybe that's the case. I don't remember. Back to you, Dick.
I made the mistake of saying from 12, Apollo 12 to Apollo 17 would be 6 units. Obviously, Apollo 13 did not put an LSEP package on the moon, so therefore only 5 of them were put up there. But apparently all 5, you believe, are not operating at this time. And which of the missions did put a corner cube optical retroreflector so that they could be laser ranged? Was it, again, Apollo 12 through 17 was proposed to put those retroreflectors up, Paul? Over here, Paul, KQRIW.
Oh, I thought they all had them. And by the way, there were 6 because they had, Apollo 11 had their own package. They mentioned the solar wind. Remember that thing looked like it was blowing around and everybody said, look, there's wind there. But Apollo 11 had it as well. It's just that that was not RTG. They didn't have the radio isotope thermoelectric generator. It had some kind of solar panel hooked up to that thing. So they did have that. So you're right. They did have 11. They did have 6. So just that there were 5 RTGs, but a total of 6. Back to you, Dick.
Now, by way of those retroreflectors, they confirmed the theory. The theory I'm talking about is that the moon is moving away from the Earth approximately 1.5 inches every year. Percentage-wise, out of 240,000 miles, 238,000 miles, 1.5 inches out of 230,000 miles is a very, very small percentage. But with a good laser ranging device into a corner reflector, you can easily resolve that. And what's causing that to happen is the tides. The moon gives you excess gravity on the near side of the Earth. The tide, the water on the Earth, bulges in that direction. We call it high tide. And because the moon and the Earth are a binary system, they both revolve around a mass center, the so-called baryon center. That baryon center is a point roughly 1,000 miles below the equator. So the moon and the Earth are both revolving around that point, 1,000 miles below the Earth equator. So that centrifugal force of the Earth wobble creates a high tide on the backside of the moon, from the moon. So Earth has 2 high tides per day of almost absolutely equal amplitude. But the Earth is turning under this bulge of water. The bulge of water is being caused by the gravity effect of the moon. So the Earth is turning under that bulge of water once every 23 hours, 56 minutes per se, sweeps through that water and creates acoustic drag. What would you call it now? Hydrostatic drag? You know what I mean? Water drag. Therefore, the bulge on the Earth is a little bit ahead, being pushed by the Earth's rotation. Let me drop it. So the moon is sensing that the mass center of the Earth is not directly below the moon. If you took a straight line and you drew it from the mass center of the Earth to the mass center of the moon, you would think somewhere along that line is the baryon center, this point 1,000 miles below the equator. Well, that point 1,000 miles below the equator is, I forget the exact number, but something like a couple of inches further ahead because of the drag on the water of the Earth rotating under that bulge of water. Therefore, the moon is being speeded up. When you take a ball and the end of a string and you move your hand in a cyclic manner, you're adding energy to that ball and you can make the ball swing faster and faster, so to speak. Well, the Earth is, by a similar procedure, adding energy to the moon, making it speed up. Well, you speed up the moon and it goes into a larger orbit at, by the way, a lower orbital period. So the moon is slowly moving outward for millions of years. At roughly 1.5 inches per year now is the current rate. Let me drop. At earlier times, it was moving at a much faster rate because the moon was a hell of a lot closer. And the whole system has to obey conservation of energy. So as you move the moon, you think you're speeding up the moon by this process. You're moving it to a larger orbit. You're putting extra kinetic energy and potential energy into the moon. And where's that energy coming from? It's coming from the Earth. So the Earth, the period of the Earth day is being slowed down by this procedure. Zillions of years ago, when the moon was a lot closer, the Earth turned a lot faster. I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me a Earth day used to be 12 hours instead of 24 hours a zillion years ago, because the moon was a hell of a lot closer then, I'd believe it. So that whole system is conserving energy, but except for the little bit of drag of the water resistance of the Earth moving underneath that bulge of water, that creates a little bit of friction drag. But the friction drag is very small compared to the energy being coupled between Earth's rotation and the moon's orbit. So that was confirmed with those retroreflectors. And one of the calculations I did 6 months or so, let me drop it, that if for some reason the tide no longer did this function of adding energy to the moon and moving it to a larger orbit, if the Earth dried up and no longer had any water, so there was no tide, you still would be getting a little bit of Earth deflection. But if we ignored all that, and you're going to put a rocket engine on the eastern side of the moon from our point of view, so that you're adding energy to the moon by blasting that rocket engine, make it an ionic engine, and you're going to run it 24/7, in order to keep moving the moon out at an inch and a half per year, how much thrust would that engine have to have? You would think that the calculation would be something very small. It was a very big number. I think it's comparable. I vaguely remember it was comparable to a Saturn V amount of thrust required to do that. So that very small shift of the tide, because the Earth is very big and the tide is very big, that very small shift of a fraction of an inch is creating that imbalance that's speeding up the moon. Kind of an interesting process going on there. Anybody have further questions on what Paul has said now, space reports, or anything you've heard tonight on any subject? Give me a call, let us right now if you've got a question or a comment. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Another good TechNet, WHCDL, always listening.
Hey, Andy, with all of that listening, by now you must have a question, a comment. You've seen something in space yourself. All those UFOs that come to your backyard that are looking at your tower and your antennas, you could describe some of those to us. So give us a report, Andy. And you and I have been discussing in the past a project that requires a microprocessor. I wonder if in the last month if there's possibly been a little bit of progress on that project. W2CDL, Commercial Driver's License, K2LIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah. Oh, let me get myself back together so I can listen to myself. There I am. I always do. Yeah, I'm actually glad you brought that up because it's been on the back burner until next week, because this is the last week of the holidays. The guy that I hooked up with has been, well, along with myself, with the holidays, we couldn't really do anything, so, but this is the last week of that, so. That's going to be over Wednesday. So after that, I want to get a hold of him and move forward. Yeah, and there's always good listening, as you know. I do a lot of that. I listen more than I talk anyway. It's good. And Paul does a great job with the space report, too, because very knowledgeable and a lot of good information to be learned. All right. Now, I got to get to sleep because I have to go get up early tomorrow to go to work. So, I can't stay up all night, but I was just here in the room and listening in for the for the short time I was in the room, but I was in another room listening before. So anyway, so I'll be in touch. I'll let you know how we make out. It'll be after Wednesday, this Wednesday, that we're going to move forward with that. Go ahead.
Repeater, time out.
I think I just timed it out. Okay, back to you.
You timed it out by 1 second, Andy. Perfect timing. Happy New Year. And by the way, you can have some fun with your friends by telling them what year it is. The current year is Topshin Ion Zion. Over to you, Andy.
Oh. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's 5277. That's a long time ago, right? So, yeah, it's it goes back a ways. All right. You know, actually, I was thinking of something interesting. But I gotta get to sleep. But I don't want to get into a big discussion because I can't stay up. But I'll ask it anyway for next week, okay? Can you do that?
Fire away with the question. I'm not sure, but I think the year might be 5777. Over you, Andy.
Yeah, I thought that's what I said, 5777.
You said 5277. Over you, Andy. What's your new question?
Oh, 50, yeah. No, not 52. I thought I said 57. Anyway, I'm tired. It's been a long day. You once was talking about when an antenna radiates a signal. The question is it true that an antenna, any antenna, no matter what, radiates a magnetic field, or electromagnetic field, an electrostatic field, an E and H field, they call it E and H, I think. Two fields, E and H, that are 90 degrees right angles to each other. Is that true?
Yes. All of the current theory of a radiated wave in free space, they call it an electromagnetic field. And if it was a vertically polarized signal, for instance, the E field, the voltage field, would be up and down. The magnetic field would be left and right. They're always at exactly right angles to each other. As far as spatial characteristics,
I'm going to interrupt because I have to go soon. Yeah, I'm talking about spatial. No interference whatsoever.
Exactly. So a vertically polarized wave, the voltage is up and down, the magnetic field is left and right, but the magnetic field and the voltage field are in phase. At one point in space where the voltages peak, at that exact same point in space, the magnetic field is also at a peak. So you could look at the magnetic field, if you stopped the action and looked at that wave, it would look a little bit like a bunch of pearls on a string, if you know what I mean. There's bubbles of energy. Those bubbles of energy are moving at the speed of light, but there are lots of people who make the mistake of thinking that the magnetic field collapses and becomes the E field, and the E field collapses and become magnetic field, and they alternate back and forth. Not at all. They're in phase in time, but at right phase in physical characteristics. So there's literally a dead spot between each half wave of that signal that's going through space. That's a little bit crazy. That's the most accepted theory of what an electromagnetic wave is, Andy. And I've got a little bit of skepticism on that. I think the magnetic field is the majority of the action. I'm not absolutely positive. The E-field
repeater, time out.
I'm not absolutely positive the E-field is really there. The rate of change of magnetic field by Faraday's law, when that signal with that changing magnetic field hits your piece of wire of your antenna, by Faraday's law, it induces a voltage in the wire. Therefore, you think there was an E field in space. I'm not convinced the E-field in space really was there. But that's another subject. You've got to hit the hay, and back to you for any final, Andy. The B2CDL, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's what I was leading up to. What induces what? Because a, you know, you take a coil of wire, you place a magnet in it, you move the magnet inside and out of the coil, produces a voltage. Now, I'm just using that as an example, because you induce a voltage from a magnetic field. The question is how. But I don't want to get into that whole thing. And then, and of course, I thought we measure field strength in microvolts per meter, and that is in microvolts. So we're measuring a voltage per meter, not a magnetic field per meter, or the question is, are we? But save this for next time, because I really have to go. Otherwise, I'll never get up tomorrow.
And you could do a calibrated measurement of volts per meter with, say, a dipole antenna. The dipole antenna has an easily calculated amount of radio area, and your half-wave dipole is resonant at your frequency. That magnetic field comes along, hits the wire of your dipole, induces a voltage. The dipole is connected to a transmission line. You and I measure that voltage, and we can calibrate that in volts per meter. But was that voltage really there in space, or did just the rate of change of magnetic field by inductive action, similar to a transformer, between that primary winding and the secondary winding of that 60-cycle transformer, the rate of change of magnetic field induces a voltage into that secondary winding. By a very similar process, that radio wave hits your dipole, induces a voltage, and you and I can measure that voltage. But you could say you were measuring the result of the rate of change of the magnetic field. It creates a voltage in our dipole. Was that voltage really there in free space? I believe the answer could be no, but not everyone's going to agree with me on that one. Bye-bye for now, Andy. Back to you for any final, K2LAW.
Yeah,
yeah,
I'm just thinking, because it gets into a deeper discussion, and of course, as we get closer to the antenna, we get into the near field of the antenna. You know, if you could see what that voltage looks like as you get closer to it, it must fill up more area of space. Well, I'm just saying that because it's the amplitude, it's the voltage that increases as you get closer to the antenna. So if you have a mobile station that's coming over to your house and you watch them on your S-meter, it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger, and you hear less and less background noise as it gets stronger. And I'm talking about either FM or AM. It doesn't make any difference the mode. I'm going to use the word cover up or fill in the background noise, atmospheric or what have you, or noise from your radio itself, thermal noise, shot noise, whatever, you know, semiconductor noise. It'll over... I'm going to say overcome that noise, but that's not the right word. Anyway, you know what I'm getting at. So I'd like to see what this looks like. As we get closer, more and more free space gets filled up. Every little molecule gets a higher amplitude of signal, and all of a sudden you look ahead of you and there's the antenna. You're staring at it, putting out whatever wattage is putting out. Anyway, all right, see you later. I gotta get going. WHCDO. I'll talk next week about it.
There are ways of setting up instrumentation such that you can get a picture, so to speak, a visualization of that wave in space. There are ways of visualizing that wave. Your eye can't do it, but with the right kind of instrumentation, it can be done. You can get a three-dimensional picture of what that wave looks like. And when you go to modeling programs like High Frequency Structure Simulator, you can ask it to give you a three-dimensional picture of what that wave looks like. Well, one of those pictures is plotting signal strength versus position in space, direction from the center of the antenna. So you can plot three-dimensional antenna patterns with some of the better available modeling programs. Let me drop it. And that helps you get a little bit of a feel for what's going on. We've all seen the antenna patterns, say, for instance, for a Yagi, where you've got a main lobe and some side lobes, and it's usually plotted as a polar plot, a two-dimensional polar plot, and there's versions where you can make it a three-dimensional spherical plot. And that amplitude versus angle of that antenna pattern gives you a useful piece of information. An interesting question is, if your eyes worked at radio frequencies, would you see that pattern? The answer is no. You would see something very different. There are people who misinterpret that antenna pattern gives you, it's a graphic technique that gives you a lot of information. How strong is the signal in each of those directions from that antenna? What's the gain in that direction, or how strong is the signal in that direction? Those antenna patterns are a representation that gives you that signal strength versus angle information. Let me drop.
Let me just add one more thing.
But if your eyes operated at radio frequencies, that is not what you would see. Over to you, Andy.
Yeah, isn't it true by looking at that polar plot and studying it carefully and seeing the difference in amplitude between the main lobe and the first side lobe and the second side lobe and the third side lobe, the amplitude of those side lobes will determine how well that antenna is constructed and how well it's performing?
That depends, Andy. And here's another one of those very controversial areas. I can't think of the man's name now who lived in Kentucky who was doing a lot of computer modeling. He was trying to design Yagi-like antennas that had zero side lobes. Zero side lobes is not a desirable Yagi antenna. When you adjust the elements, spacings, and positions, and everything else of a Yagi to maximize the gain, the first side lobe will be 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe will be 21 dB down. The third side lobe will be something like 27 dB down.
That's what I was getting at.
If you carefully adjust the antenna to have side lobes at that amplitude, you get maximum gain. You can adjust the antenna to make the side lobes a hell of a lot weaker than that. When you do that, the main lobe becomes broader and the gain goes down. There's some laws of physics dictating where the maximum gain is, and with maximum gain, you'll get those particular side lobes.
Isn't it like taking a elongated balloon, and when you squeeze it, it seems like it gets larger, and when you're squeezing it gets thinner, gets smaller, and then it expands outward?
You could say the antenna pattern is like a water-filled or air-filled balloon. It's got a certain amount of volume to it. And there's various ways you can squeeze that volume without squeeze that balloon without changing its volume to come up with various antenna patterns. That's sort of true. However, the highest gain antenna that mankind has ever seen is a parabolic dish. The highest gain antenna you and I are likely to know anything about is the Mount Palomar or the Hubble Space Telescope. The parabolic mirror on Mount Palomar is, I don't know the exact number, but it's probably 40 million wavelengths wide. It's got the highest gain you're ever going to get out of that amount of area. The eyepiece that feeds that parabolic dish, eyepiece plus the subreflector, the feed horn assembly, so to speak, gives you an even distribution of energy across that parabolic surface if you were using it as a transmitter. And it gives you the maximum gain. However, the highest possible gain antenna, like Mount Palomar, has a side lobe. First side lobe is 17 dB down, second side lobe is 21 dB down, and so on. It's called the airy disc antenna pattern. Every high gain parabolic dish that's well tuned for maximum performance has that exact antenna pattern. Let me drop. Good common sense would lead you to believe that those side lobes represent wasted energy. Good common sense. Wrong. Those side lobes have to be there. Mother Nature doesn't like the fact that you create an abrupt discontinuity. You've got an even distribution of energy across that 200-inch diameter, carefully designed parabolic reflector. But that energy abruptly falls to zero at the perimeter of that 200-inch reflector. Mother Nature doesn't like an abrupt discontinuity. She's got the fancy kinds of mathematics, Fourier transform-like mathematics, that dictates you will get side lobes in that function. You could slowly taper the energy as you go out toward the tip of the parabolic dish. You could make those side lobes as weak as you like, but because you're tapering the energy and the perimeter is not being used to full capability, you will have less gain. So when you maximize the gain, those particular side lobes have got to be there. You make the side lobes stronger than those magic numbers, you'll have less gain. You make the side lobes weaker than those magic numbers, you'll have less gain. You make the side lobes those exact magic numbers, you'll have maximum gain. That's kind of crazy. Good night for now, Andy. The W2CDL, 73, to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, all right, let me just, hold on. Got the beep. Yeah, I saw this in a physics book. Actually, they were doing the calculus study of parabolic dishes and how the reflections of the dish, how they're created. I'm just trying to think of the way to word it, but you know what I'm talking about. All right, anyway, I gotta go. All right. See you later. It's interesting. It's a long discussion though, because it takes a lot of measurements to understand it. See you later. WHCDL. I gotta go. It's almost 12:00. Good night.
A young human eye that's dark adapted. The iris opens to something like 7 millimeters. 7 millimeters at optical wavelength. 540 nanometers, that's a lot of wavelengths. Let me think that. Half, 540 nanometers is roughly half a micrometer. Half a micrometer, 2,000 micrometers per millimeter, 7 of those. So I guess it's something like 14,000 wavelengths is the iris of your eye. It's a lot of wavelengths. It's a light bucket. A tiny little black dot in the center of your eye, 7 millimeters diameter, if you're a young person with a dark adapted eye and your iris is fully open, it's gathering light. But you compare the amount of light your eye can gather compared to a 200-inch diameter mirror of Mount Palomar, which is a good-sized telescope produced in the late 30s and early 40s, and nowadays they're designing optical telescopes that are many times bigger than that. When you got a bigger telescope as a light bucket gathering up millions and millions of times more light than your eye, that's where all the sensitivity is coming from. That combined with a very low light camera, my goodness, can you see things. In the case of Hubble with the ultra deep field, 1 million second exposure, my goodness, did it see things. It looked into a dark direction of space where they thought there was nothing, but they said, what the hell, we'll look out there for 1 million seconds and see if anything comes out of the noise. And they saw 2,600 galaxies that have never seen before in that tiny little section of space, which is the equivalent of you and I holding a straw in front of your face and looking down the straw. You're holding the straw at arm's length, and the amount of sky you can see through that straw is approximately what the Hubble Deep Field picture is looking at. And you got 10,000 galaxies in that little chunk of space is what Hubble saw. There's not a lot of stuff out there. We ain't alone. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me a call, letters right now. And John, if you happen to see one more question on your mailbag, you can bring that up. K2LIW listening.
One quick thing, WS2N.
You got it, Paul.
The amateur radio on the American side of the International Space Station is, right now, it's officially broken. So they're getting error messages. So any future Ares contacts, they're going to use the Kenwood radio in the Russian side. So this is going to be an ongoing story. I'd like to see them send up a new one on a new cargo ship. You have a couple of cargo ships going up in December. I know they have to all be, you know, tested and checked out, but my guess they must have a spare laying around somewhere that's already been space qualified. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
The fact that the amateur radio transmitter receiver combination, whatever it was, on the American side has failed. How did you find that out, Paul? Are you one of the guys that have communicated with it? And the Russians are using a Kenwood radio, a Japanese radio. I guess it's about to ask, how come they're not using a Russian radio? By the same token, how come the Americans are not using an American radio, a Tentec? Tentec is the main brand name in the United States that still exists. So we also use Japanese automobiles and Japanese radios because you get the best bang for the dollar. So how did you find out about that failure, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Ways. One was through the ARRL. They send emails out, so you might have that in your computer that maybe you didn't read yet. You get these notifications, and then the Ares website and all, you know, you just, one thing leads to another. The American side, well, you know, it's an international space station, so, you know, I don't care. As long as they have radios on board, that's good. It's just that this is the first time it's failed since it's been up there since 2001. And what client we're using an HT. It's an Emerson HT for 2 meters. And there's two of them up there, from what I understand. One is set for 70 centimeters. The other one's set for 2 meters. And that's on the Columbus module. I mean, the Columbus module, if you think about it, is the European Space Agency module that's been put up on the space station. That's their addition. Just like you have the Japanese Kaibo, and you have the American Destiny, and you've got the Russian modules and so forth. So right now it happens to be located in the Columbus module. And that's where most of our contacts have generated from there. A lot of Russian ones and different countries have come out of the Russian side. Back to you there.
The International Space Station is at, I don't know the exact number, but something like 200 miles high. It's above 99.9% of the atmosphere, so to speak. And therefore, it's just barely touching the atmosphere, but still it is experiencing atmospheric drag, and it's slowly settling to a lower altitude. Periodically, it's got to be boosted to a higher altitude. In the past, the space shuttle used to do a lot of that boosting. Every time you had a space shuttle visiting with some fuel left over, it did some boosting. Well, the space shuttle hasn't been to the International Space Station for a long time. Who nowadays is doing the boosting? And when's the last time that the International Space Station received a boost? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
And that was probably a month or so ago before the Progress ship had left. All the Progress ships that come up do that. They also send a Progress ship up with fuel, and that fuels the Zvezda module. That's the Russian module, the big Russian module. And then that has rockets on board, so that's able to use thrusters to accelerate the space station. The shuttle, of course, hasn't been up since 2011. And other cargo ships, not the Cygnus or the SpaceX, but in the future, we'd be doing that. The ATV, that was last year when, about a year and a half ago, they stopped going up. They had a tremendous amount of fuel on board. So they still do it. they know to have the capability of continuing on with that process. The Japanese module, that doesn't have one either. That'll be going up probably about 3 months or so. Most of the progress is the one that is handling that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I got some more questions about boosting of both the space station, International Space Station, and Tangang, whatever. This was Space Report TechNet number 1624. That was Space Report number 224. We've come to the end. Bye bye, you all. Be kind to each other. See you next week. Come up with some more questions. No guarantee for the answers. I was pretty wrong early tonight on the. Where is the standing wave ratio measurement on the MFJ super large impedance matcher, antenna tuner? Oh well, we're learning. Over to you, John, for tying on the ribbons. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Good night, John. Over to you. Good night, Chet.
Hey, good night, Gracie. Okay, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on the net, for sending the questions in. Good stuff. Had a good night tonight, and if everything goes well, and we're all kind to each other, we'll be back next week, and we will have a prize, because we're going to be answering all of the questions next week correctly. KC2WGB. Paul, over to you, sir.
73, John and Andy, good for listening. Thanks for stopping by, 73, and over to you, Dick, if you want to say anything else. Who's the other guy? Good night, Chet. Good night, David. David, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it was called the Huntley-Brinkley Report. One of them was called Chet, and I forget what the other, David and Chet, something like that. They used to say good night to each other, night after night, the Huntley-Brinkley Report, way back in the, I guess that was the 60s or the 70s. 73, you all. K2RIW clear.
Yeah, they did a great job of covering the early rocket flights. I remember them. Very good. 73, guys. WS to NPR.
It was Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, N2 NBR.
That's right. Very good.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the WQVL repeater.
WB2CON, WB2CON, New York City, listening.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
QRZ, QRZ, WB2CON. QRZ, QRZ, WB2CON. QRZ, QRZ, WB2CON.
D2JAF Mobile, listening.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur
ABQFT Mobile.